Good morning and welcome to our Public Asset Management Committee call. Today is November 18th. My name is Ian Bruch, Chief Investment Officer of the Trust Company. I am joined as always by our team of portfolio managers, which includes Tim Vick in Naples, Andrew Vanderhorst and Brianna McDougall up in Tampa, and our Sanibel team, which includes Ed Siskowski, Gary Dyer, Craig Holston and Joel Johnson. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. And you can visit our website for full disclosures. Well, from an infection standpoint, the global growth rate for coronavirus has moderated week over week, which is somewhat good to see just across the world. We're still growing cases at about 1.1% per day on a seven-day moving average. However, there's just not much movement week over week, which is somewhat good to see. Europe is obviously still very concerning, but what we're noticing is some of the Southern Hemisphere countries that are entering their summer months as we enter our winter months, we're seeing case increases dwindle. And just to point out a few, you know, India and Brazil have been hot spots throughout most of the summer, and we're starting to see that curve at least bend in the right direction. They're still adding their cases, but at a slower rate. So we're clearly seeing an influx of cases in colder climates here in the U.S. and across Europe, which will, I think, will remain a concern as we move through our typical flu season here over the next few months. Here in the United States, last week on our call, I had mentioned the seven-day moving average growth rate was about 1.3%. That was up week over week. This week through yesterday, that moved up to about 1.45%. So the curve is still moving higher. Week over week. We're seeing caseloads increase week over week across pretty much every state at this point. And the number of tests that are being done at this point, we're getting about a collective 10% positivity rate, which is pretty high. It's higher than the 7% rate we were at back in July and August when we had that little bit of a summer second wave. And really 10% positivity of the tests being done is really the highest level we've seen. You have to kind of go back to May to get to those numbers. Obviously, this is bringing about renewed pressure on hospital capacity, and we're seeing some fresh restrictions from states and cities. I'd say notably, the New York Times reported yesterday that New York City schools are going to be closing today, I believe, amid the ongoing wave of COVID-19. The shutdown was prompted by the city reaching a 3% positive rate over a seven-day rolling average. And then earlier that afternoon, Governor Cuomo warned that a 3% average in New York City would trigger a shutdown of indoor dining, gyms, and other what they note as high-risk non-essential businesses. And so that level would also place the city into that state-designated orange zone, which calls for business closings and capacity limits for mass gatherings and houses of worship. So, we're probably likely to see more of this, not less of this, over the next few weeks, depending on the how bad this wave gets that we're currently in. And now, at the same time, that was a lot of negative news around the virus. There's certainly some promising vaccine news that some of you may have already heard about, but we did just want to mention that Moderna released their initial efficacy results, similar to what Pfizer had released just a few weeks prior. That number came in around 94%, which is outstanding. That was followed by another report from Pfizer upping their efficacy numbers to 95%. So it seems likely, and that was up from the original 90. So it does seem likely now that both Pfizer and Moderna have viable vaccines that are likely to get approved at some point here in the next several weeks. I believe the group that's going to decide on this has a meeting scheduled for early December. So when we get back from Thanksgiving, we'll be that much closer to hopefully some positive vaccine news. And then this morning, we actually received news from mid-stage trials from the Oxford University and AstraZeneca vaccine candidate showing a strong immune response in older adults. The data, which was published in a medical journal, suggested that those over the age of 70 could build robust immunity to this disease with their drug. So late stage or phase three trials are ongoing to confirm those findings. So we'll continue to watch that, but just another tidbit of good news on the vaccine front. We're continuing to see kind of a broadening out in the stock market rally here near term as the cyclical value dividend paying stocks continue to increase at a slightly quicker pace than what we've noticed out of growth technology companies. And that's really been when we look back about 3 months now, those sorts of stocks are performing better than growth stocks now by about 2 to 3%. But most of that has just come in the past few weeks, again on the back of some of this vaccine news that we just discussed. Despite the worsening coronavirus trends and new restrictions that are expected to weigh on the overall economy, nothing is really happening in Washington right now with regards to an additional fiscal stimulus package. The two sides, being the Republicans and the Democrats, remain pretty far apart on the size and the scope of the next package that they want to see. Democrats want something in the range of 2.2 trillion, whereas Republicans want more of a half a trillion dollar amount. So they're still pretty far apart. Unfortunately, it's probably going to take COVID to get meaningfully worse here in the short term to get them to move quicker on a additional stimulus package. We do still expect that to come at some point, but I think odds are it's not going to become law and happen until early next year. But that the news flow around that tends to change day by day, so we'll keep you updated on that front. And I did just want to mention another news report that had come out just recently, highlighting this was from the Institute of International Finance that basically noted, probably not surprising to anyone on this call, but worth mentioning, just noting the sharp rise in government and corporate borrowing in response to the coronavirus increased to a total level of global indebtedness, on top of what we were already in debt by 15 trillion additional dollars. Leaving it on track to exceed 277 trillion this year. So total debt is expected to reach 365% of global GDP by the end of this year, and that's up from 320% at the end of just this last year. So obviously we were carrying a significant amount of debt going into coronavirus, given all of the fiscal monetary stimulus we've only added to that. And the IIF was simply warning that the pace of the debt accumulation could make it difficult for the global economy to reduce borrowing in the future without significant adverse implications for economic activity. So that's a longer term risk, obviously, that we see out there on the horizon is just the amount of indebtedness that we've added to our system. The stock market in the near term is loving it because it's more money that can be used for productive use and investment in the stock markets. But let's all just recognize that we've taken on debt to pass these fiscal packages, and probably more to come on that front. From an economic standpoint, just over the past week, wanted to bring a few data points to you. I had mentioned last week the Consumer Price Index, which is just a broad measure of inflation. That came in a little lower than I think what people were hoping for. We did get the Producer Price Index, which was released last Friday. So both with the Consumer Price Index and the Producer Price Index, which measures more of the input costs into the system, we're seeing pretty meager inflation results. The month-over-month increase was only 0.1%. On a year-over-year basis, the PPI increased at 1%. So still well below, I think, the 2% that the Fed is eyeing from an inflation standpoint. So we're going to continue to keep a close eye on both employment and inflation as the Fed is going to be watching those closely over the next several years to set their interest rate policy. On Tuesday of this week, the 17th, we had retail sales data reported for the month, which came in at a growth rate of 0.3%, which was slightly lower than the 0.5% expectation. So we'll call that slightly disappointing. Month over month. One bright spot of the economy continues to be housing. Building permits came in a bit higher than expected, not by much, but just modestly higher. And then housing starts remain pretty strong, growing at 5% last month versus the 2.5% that was expected by economists. So that continues to be a bright spot. And if any of you have tried to buy or sell a home in the last few months, you've probably witnessed how hot the real estate market is in certain areas of the country. Initial unemployment claims were released this morning. Those came in at 742,000 versus 711 last week. So that was a bit disappointing. It's a reminder that the labor markets are going to continue to be choppy here over the next few months. Continuing unemployment claims came in lower than last week, but a little bit higher than what was expected again. So before I pass this along, we did receive a question from a listener, and I'll just repeat the question here. Does the trust company use ETFs and index funds to invest in economic sectors like biotech, gaming, and data security, where it's not clear who the eventual winners will be? And I would just say we do use mutual funds and ETFs in certain accounts occasionally to provide an additional amount of diversification to fill an asset class exposure. So we do use them. It's usually not to over or underweight a particular sector of the economy. We typically try to do the individual research on the individual companies. And just, generally speaking, we do have a bias for some of the largest companies in the world, which tend to have tentacles into a lot of these industries anyway. So it's almost a safer way to kind of play some of these industries that are exciting. You can find a lot of exposure just by looking at some of the world's largest, most well-capitalized companies. So we do feel like we're well exposed from a sector standpoint where we want to be. We do use ETFs and mutual funds, but it's again just to kind of round out some diversification or a particular asset class exposure that we're wanting, but less so tied to sectors. But nonetheless, thank you for sending that question in and keep them coming. It's never too late to send in a question on these calls, and thanks for your participation. With that said, I will hand it over to Tim. Tim, could you give us just a quick rundown on just kind of near-term markets and what we've been seeing between growth and value? Thanks.
Sure. Thank you, Ian, and good morning, everybody. We're so glad you chose to join us again. And of course, we're going to extend our very best wishes to you and your families for Thanksgiving. I just want to spend a couple minutes tagging on to a couple of comments Ian just made about recent activity. Last Monday, something really extraordinary occurred in the stock market, something that was never predicted, something that defied all the odds, caught thousands of professional investors flat-footed, and frankly, had never occurred before. And in the end, it was one of the most satisfying turn of events we've experienced for our clients. And I'm talking about the rally that began when Pfizer announced their initial results from its COVID vaccine trial. Pfizer, as Ian just told the world that their new vaccine was showing to be more than 90% effective in keeping participants in the trial from getting infected. And since that time, Pfizer has provided further details on the same study that confirmed the initial results, while Moderna, as Ian mentioned, has likewise seen close to 95% effectiveness on its new vaccine. Now, those news items were exactly what the stock market needed to hear at that moment in time. It was news of a possible cure, a possible end to the shutdown and the quarantines, a possible end to the recession, corporate sales and earnings rebounding faster than expected, a stock market that was now justified in moving to new heights. Last Monday, we saw just how quickly the market switched gears and plowed money into stocks that were mostly beaten up from the recession. And I can point out some examples like cruise line stocks. They shot up 30% just last Monday. Real estate stocks shot up 25%. Airline stocks rose 20%. Retailers rose 20%. Large banks like JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, they went up 10% to 15% in a single day. And of course, oil and industrial stocks rose 10% as well. And equally surprising was the instantaneous movement of all the stocks that had been leading the market higher since April. I'm talking about Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, PayPal, Tesla, Nvidia, Shopify, Adobe. All of these fell 5% to 10%, and within minutes of the market opening on Monday, they fell on what should have been very positive news for the economy and for all the stocks. Now, this unprecedented turnover away from growth and momentum stocks into cyclical, high dividend paying, what we call value stocks, it's carried on. And in the last 10 trading days, the S&P 500 has risen 9%, which is a phenomenal move unto itself. But the index has been carried this time by what we'd call a second tier of value stocks that are now propping up the market. At the same time, the tech stocks have drifted a bit lower. And we're already reading stories of hedge funds and algorithmic traders who lost just vast amounts of money last Monday betting on growth stocks while they were betting against value stocks and cyclicals. And a few of these managers were quoted as saying that this was a once in a trillion occurrence that should never have happened. And of course, they're all blaming a faulty stock market and not their own trading models. Now, as we see it, this rally that started last Monday, it may not be long lasting, and we're certainly not about to go out on a limb and predictive value stocks are going to start outperforming it again. But I think these last 10 days have served up several really important lessons we can all take away as 2020 comes to an end. And the first lesson is that the stock market has been obsessed with the virus and the economy. Everything else has taken a backseat. All the major movements in the stock market this year, up or down, were caused by economic data. They were caused by news about the virus. It was caused by the prospects of federal stimulus to pull us out of recession. That's almost always the way it works, the way it works in financial markets. Ultimately, the most important news to focus on is news that impacts the performance of the economy and businesses. I think the second lesson we're learning is that there is still plenty of ammunition and fuel for the stock market to keep rising. Now, we now know that there are trillions of dollars in cash sitting on the sidelines that's ready to go back into stocks when the economic data improves. We know, too, that institutional money managers cannot just hoard cash that's currently earning zero. Their money has to be invested somewhere. And if tech stocks aren't working, they're not incentivized to park money in cash. They have to move clients' money into what is working. I think a third lesson is, and this is very vital to us now in retrospect, politics were barely a factor in the stock market in 2020. Even when our own president was being impeached in January and February, it did not impact stock prices. This is something we've been saying for months as we tried to calm a lot of you down from shifting your investment strategies during an election year. Basing your investing decisions on your political beliefs, once again, did not work, as it did not work in 2008, in 2012, and in 2016. Fear and outrage, or fear of the other guy winning the White House, has not been a winning strategy this year, nor has it ever been. And I hope that we can all take that to heart and redirect our focus in the coming months away from Washington. I think another lesson is that the market is always forward-looking, always. If you wonder why stocks fell 34% in March, it's because investors were already anticipating just how bad the economy was going to slump in the summer and fall. It was already anticipating how much sales and earnings were going to fall at restaurants and at retailers and at airlines and for cruise ships and hotels. It was already expecting that millions of people would be laid off and unable to sustain their household spending. The market figured all that out months ago. Now, the past couple of months, the market has been rising, and despite very poor economic and earnings data, and that's because investors are already calculating how strong the economy is going to bounce back next year. And investors have been optimistically betting that we'd have vaccines developed that will slow or halt COVID and allow the economy to fully reopen. Pfizer's news last Monday, I think, just fast-tracked those predictions. I think another lesson we've learned is pretty simple. Don't try to time this market, and don't try to follow momentum. It can change on a dime, and certainly when you least expect it. Sticking it out during the market turbulent periods and economic crises has once again shown to be the best strategy, rather than pulling money in and out of the market and likely missing the past 10 days of gains as a result. And then here's another lesson we just realized. The stock market is not overvalued, and you shouldn't be afraid to put money to work. Instead, the S&P 500, as Ian has pointed out many times, has been led upward since April by about 10 large technology stocks that had accounted for the entire index's 2020 gain. But you go beneath the surface, and there were still hundreds of stocks that were well off their highs and offered opportunities for us to purchase these securities for you at decent prices. They offered decent forward rates of return, too, if you were patient. But at no time since April have we felt the market was frothy and that we shouldn't or couldn't find opportunities for you. And then finally, I think a lesson we've learned from all this is stay diversified within your stock portfolio so that you're always participating in what happens to be working at the moment. And stick to the financial plans and the asset allocation strategies that you've created with your advisors. A typical portfolio of ours these days contains a mix of growth stocks, tech stocks, high dividend paying stocks, value stocks, and cyclicals, all blended in a way to hit your long-term rate of return goals, and so that some elements in your portfolio may be working when others aren't. I mean, we've learned over time there's no such thing as a perfect market that rises steadily and lifts all your stock holdings equally. Some, like tech stocks, can roar ahead for months while others just languish for months. So over long periods of time, however, we would expect all the holdings to add value to your portfolio, just not at the same time. But anyway, I thought I'd put those thoughts on the table. I appreciate your time letting me bring these issues up today. And with that, I'll turn it back to Ian.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate that. Ed, something we haven't touched on in probably several weeks, but you did a good job of highlighting back in the midst of the height of the volatility earlier on this year is what fund flow data is looking like in terms of U.S. mutual funds. Could you give us a sense of where things stand?
Sure, Ian, and good morning, everyone, and wishing everybody happy holidays over the next 6 weeks or so. We haven't touched on money flow for a while, just a flurry of other information, and this will tie into some of the things Ian's mentioned as well as what Tim just mentioned. But we have data through November 11th, and we look at this data on an equity, bond fund, money market fund basis, and we kind of break all of it down. The week of the 11th of November had the first week of equity inflows in 14 weeks on a net basis. Obviously, every week you have some inflows, but prior 14 weeks to last week in the market were outflows of equities on a net basis. Here we had an inflow of almost $24 billion on a net basis. And I want you to keep that $24 billion in your head for a second, because we're going to talk for a second about total money in the money market. Currently, it sits around $4.3 trillion, and that's down from the peak in late September of $4.6 trillion. So $300 billion have come into the market, broadly speaking, bonds and equities. Since the peak of money sitting in money markets in September. And roughly almost 10% of that came into equities on the Moderna Pfizer news. So while you had many managers altering allocations at that point, maybe coming out of tech stocks, moving into some of the dividend payers and the cyclicals, you also had a flood of money coming into the market, getting exposed generally from some of this money that had been sitting on the bench. The balance of that money has largely gone into bond funds over the last 6 weeks, who have seen record inflows week after week. So essentially, people had money sitting in a money market fund, and they put that money to work in bonds, gradually kind of getting exposure again, and then put some more money, a big slug, into equities once we saw the news that we had a successful candidate or two for vaccine, which would potentially relieve the economy of the lockdown sometime next year, hopefully. But I want to talk about that 4.3 trillion that's still out there and just give you some perspective on that. That is versus a number of, call it 3.8, that was sitting on the bench in the Great Recession, which was a much more dangerous time because the financial service industry was basically on the precipice of going upside down. So money right now is more cautious than it was then. That is also $2 trillion higher than it was in the 2000 tech wreck. So the amount of money sitting on the bench right now is as high as it's ever been. It's 20% higher than where it was in the Great Recession, and it's 200% higher than where it was in the tech wreck. So there is still an awful lot of money that is waiting to do something. And what's interesting is if you look at the market, the S&P 500, from the peak on Valentine's Day to the trough on March 23rd, the market declined about 31.7% during that period. Since March 23rd through yesterday, the market's up a whopping 56.6%. So if you timed this wrong, if you got out and you did not come back in, that 57% return, first of all, it locks you into a loss and it doesn't allow you to participate in that return. And depending upon how much you got back in and when you got banned again, that amount of return that's lost, it's impossible to make that up with stock picking. And that's why we consistently talk about having a plan and staying with the plan. Because these returns are so volatile each way that if you make a mistake and if you sell, then you have to buy. And that's two different decisions. If you just stay put, that's one decision. It's easier to make one decision than two or more. So the bottom line is massive volatility. Markets up about 12% for the year. Obviously, a lot of that's been driven by tech stocks. We're starting to see some rotation out of cash into bonds and into equities due to some of these fantastic results that we're seeing from the pharma industry as it relates to the vaccine. And we hope to see some more of that coming. But that money is sitting on cash as the market has moved materially. And, you know, that is a decision that someone's going to have to make sitting on that money. Do I want to invest it now? But it's still out there and it's still a potential proponent to future growth. Thanks, Ian, and back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. That's an interesting summary and just a good reminder for all of us to kind of stick to those long-term investment plans. We sound like a broken record espousing long-term investing, but in a year like 2020, it highlights its importance more than ever. So thanks for that. Gary, we are now towards the back end of Q3 earnings season. Could you just give us a quick summary of how earnings have looked just from kind of a broad landscape for the third quarter? Thanks.
Sure, Ian, and good morning, everyone. Third quarter earnings season is almost complete, with over 90% of the companies in the S&P 500 index already reporting results at this point. Of these companies, 84% have reported earnings per share above the Wall Street consensus estimate, which is well above the five-year average of 73%. In addition, the magnitude of those earnings beats has been very impressive, approximately 20% above the estimate versus the five-year average of 6%. Now, keep in mind, on an absolute basis, the third quarter earnings per share actually fell 7% versus the third quarter of 2019. It's also interesting to note that there's five sectors within the S&P 500 that reported year-over-year absolute earnings per share growth, and that was led by the healthcare sector, while six sectors posted a decline in year-over-year earnings, and that was led by energy and the industrial sectors. And really, revenue paints a very similar picture. Of those companies in the S&P 500 that reported, 78% had sales above the Wall Street consensus, which is well above the five-year average of 61%. In addition, again, the magnitude of those revenue beats was above average, approximating between 2 and 3% versus the five-year average of between 0.5% and 1%. However, again, like earnings results, the S&P 500's third quarter sales results were off about 2% in comparison to the same period the prior year on an absolute basis. Now, looking forward, analysts predict a year-over-year earnings decline of approximately 11% in the fourth quarter for the S&P 500 index. However, Wall Street is much more optimistic about 2021, with the S&P 500 first quarter earnings expected to rise almost 15% in comparison with the first quarter of 2020. Now, before I end our discussion of financial trends, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the current level of a valuation metric that the investment team keeps a very close eye on, which we really helps us with our security selection decisions. And that's the price to earnings ratio, also known as a PE ratio. At present, the forward 12-month PE ratio of the S&P 500 is between 21 and 22 times, and the 5-year and 10-year averages are between 17 and 18 and 15 and 16 times, respectively. Now, I know that both Ian and Tim already mentioned that these metrics have been extended primarily due to the fact that the technology sector has really taken off over the last 6 to 9 months. And those are very top heavy in the S&P 500. And so a lot of companies still are relatively fairly valued other than the tech sector, But that has made it very difficult for the team to find a lot of tech companies that are relatively fairly valued. So I just want to stress that the team is going to continue to stay very true to its knitting and not try to chase these tech stocks with high valuations just because their current momentum plays. So back to you, Ian.
Thank you, Gary. Good summary and much appreciated. We did have, I'll just touch on one final question that came in regards to have a lot of companies cut dividends during this period of time. And I would just say, you know, the obvious areas of the economy, whether it be travel, leisure, hotels, restaurants, the energy space, we have seen some dividend cuts in some of those hardest hit industries. But broadly speaking, you know, if you just roll up consumer-based companies, healthcare, industrial, bank companies, although the stock prices have been in some cases pretty depressed in 2020, most of the dividends remain intact. I mean, that's the beauty of buying great, large, well-capitalized companies is, you know, a lot of these, if revenue and earnings falls for a few quarters in response to economic weakness, whether it's a pandemic or otherwise, generally speaking, a lot of these businesses have the fortress balance sheets to hold them through and allow them to continue to pay dividends. So dividends continue to be pretty robust and consistent through time, even with some of the stock market volatility that we've experienced this year. It's not contractually obligated like it is on a bond instrument, but we find that dividends are pretty sticky through time. And companies do a lot of things to avoid cutting their dividends. So we get that near-term stock price volatility. Stocks go up and down every day, but those dividends are pretty consistent and still good value in that space, as we've been saying this morning. So thanks for that question. And thanks, as always, for joining us. Just a reminder, if you didn't see it in the invitation, next week is Thanksgiving. So we will skip 1 week and be back the first week of December on this call. Thank you, as always, for joining us, and have a good Thanksgiving with your families and friends. Take care.